President Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Henry, appreciate your testimony today. I just want to ask you your perspective on something might help me in my thinking. My dad grew up in Oklahoma, not too far away from you. Poor kids, farm kids, a number of Native American kids in their student body, but by and large, extremely poor. Not sophisticated teaching methods, not much materiel in schools and so forth. And my dad has a high school diploma, but that's all he's got. And yet, I'm just continually amazed at how smart he is, you know, and how good he is at everything from reading, writing. He's great in numbers and things like that. And in this whole discussion on schools of yesteryear, schools of today, I get confused sometimes because I want to be generalistic and simplistic here and run back to what he became with what little he had financially and materiel-wise in his schools, but he always raves about the teachers he had, people who really cared about them and exhibited that in a number of ways. Is there any way you can connect the dots between the craft as practiced back in those days, which would have been the 40s, the early 40s, to today? Is the craft, the art of teaching, the same, or are we just talking apples and oranges and you can't make any comparison between teaching in that era and teaching today?
Chair, Representative Wilson, I think we can make comparisons during that period of time. Oftentimes we don't want to do it. And we want to sort of set aside the legacy that the individuals had during that period of time. I think about the period where we had integration in Texarkana, Texas, and where all the black teachers lost their jobs. And many of them had better credentials than white teachers did. They lost their job because the feeling was that black teachers couldn't teach white kids. And that aspect of it. Then we got confused a great deal later by looking at credentials as a way of screening out people. Yeah, I never believe that one is educated primarily because of the credentials alone. I said people are highly trained because of the credentials. The education comes less through a process that you are talking about and others are talking about in the process of molding and working with people and dealing with people, in my judgment. I think that side of education, in some ways, would probably cast aside because everybody's looking for a credential rather than look for the person that's able to reach someone and be able to articulate and express themselves and be able to develop along those lines. And sometimes that is done, the credential aspect of it gets involved a little bit in what we talked about with the racism, the ways of screening people out and not letting them involve the process. Because we want a person to have certain kind of credentials. We don't really want them to have it. We want that person to have it rather than looking at other end. I think that some of the precepts and concepts that was used in the father's time would be very invaluable to us today if we would use them. But we're afraid to use them because we don't have somebody to come up and say, that is the way we want to go. But I think in many instances, some of that stuff is coming by. People now begin to look at the legacy of getting involved. The teacher-student interaction are crucial to that if we're going to be successful with it. Or understanding the culture and the background of the children today. When people think about culture, sometimes they think in terms of racial terms. It's not necessarily so. We're talking about people who are even sick, the different kinds of sickness that we have. People have cultures and what would cause them to function different kinds of ways, the handicaps of the others. But now we're getting people to begin to look at those issues a little bit different and try to bridge that gap. But still, we're not there yet in a multitude of ways. And we don't see the dialogue interacting because the people at the top who are setting the standards for people to follow down below are not looking at how we need to get those people involved in the process.
Representative Winters?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kevin, I'd like to follow up just a little bit more on the question that Representative Beck made with respect to the poverty and the single parent and some of those issues. And your answer, I thoroughly appreciate. Because doesn't, in your opinion, doesn't that also bring in that the teacher who is coming into the classroom has those kinds of expectations, and because of those kinds of expectations and how they view that community and that youngster, have already begin to transmit that child cannot learn?
Yes, that is the case, and that was the case even at Jefferson in terms of period of time that I was there, and I did the study. Just that a lot of people had images about the students that prevented them from really reaching the young at point to help develop them.
And on the other side, from the student's thought, that student already knows that the teacher feels that way about him and her. It's kind of like when we used to have the dialogues several years ago, when we would say to the Lake Oswego community, if you don't get engaged with us, your children don't know what our children are like. Our children see you on the TV all the time, so they have a much better appreciation of who you are than you have of who we are. So the child already has an anticipation of what they expect the teacher's going to do. Is that?
You're absolutely right. That is a factor that we necessarily need to build. When I say teachers need to understand the children whom they're teaching, I mean in that perspective, because oftentimes the children understand the teachers better than the teachers understand them. And not only that, the teachers, out of most of the teachers that were teaching at the school, they came from afar into the neighborhood and then leave at the end of the day. Many of them don't go and say, go to the churches or go to the community activities for the students. The minimal is that. They said they had to be invited. When I was growing up, teachers were not invited. They came. And they wanted to know more about the individual.
Representative Jensen?
Just editorial comment on that. I really appreciate that point. And today, so often, and we have no apparent way to control it, our teachers are not part of the communities that they teach in. And I think this contrasts a lot with Representative Olson's statements, and maybe it was poverty and that sort of thing, but likely the teachers were part of the community. And we don't even sometimes live in the same town. Sometimes we commute 40, 50 miles on the freeway to get to the schools where we're at. And so we have no touch with the students. We have no touch with the parents. As Dr. Emmer says, we have no touch with the churches, the institutions where the children are coming from. And if there's one thing I'd like to see, it would be to be a way to get back to that. And I realize that may be beyond the realm of this particular body's ability, but, you know.
Representative Jensen. One of the things that I think is within your bounds, in my view, is that you can help us begin to understand that we're in this thing together. You know, I don't want to get into charter schools definition, but the question still that do we believe in public education? That is a question that you'll have to address sooner or later. But it's one of those things that people need to understand that we do believe in public education. And we do believe that the education of all the children in order to develop our democratic way of life, or we're going to go up in smoke. I think that is one of the things that we can really do. I think you have the power to address that a little bit. Because, see, I don't see us really looking, trying to work to fix what we believe that is wrong with public education, if we think that something is wrong with it. see us looking at trying to find another way to avoid dealing with it and create another dilemma for ourselves in the long run. My whole point of even of the report of Jefferson was to try to help Jefferson High School begin to remove the scale, remove the scale over the wound, so that they can see what is really going on, so that we can begin to solve the problem of educating children at Jefferson High School. And to look at what my findings were, to be able to say to the teachers and to the administrators there, as well as to the schools from which the students come, what you necessarily need to do to help prepare, better prepare those students to be able to function at the level they want them to function. Oftentimes, we are afraid to go out and say to one school to send us kids that are ill-prepared, if you send us ill-prepared kids, and we necessarily need you to do a better job of preparing them. Once we get them, we're afraid to deal with providing the skills that the kids need in order to be successful at the level they are. And there are a number of reasons why we're not doing that. But I think in many ways, that you as legislators can help us understand that we've got to begin to work together. And we need public education to be very effective, accountable, and responsive. And one of the ways that I think that is the big task. And I think what you're talking about is something that we necessarily need to do. We need to have a dialogue much stronger than we did, rather than just coming here once upon a time to deal with it. And I would say to you is that my report is accurate. Now, I know the district is trying to portray a different image to you. Now, for what reason, I don't know. But I would say to you, rather than it should have been using the data to move forward. And I know they have been using the data. And I'm glad that things have changed over the 2 years or 3 years since I did that report. It seemed like the assistant to the superintendent was dealing with the fact that things have changed today. He used current data rather than the data at that time. And if I can be a further...
Representative Morissette. Thank you. I apologize for having to leave. I had a matter to take care of. And this question may have been answered, and I think Representative Hobson was dealing with it when I left. About 15 years ago, I taught at Springfield High School for a number of years, and there was a white female teacher who went to Portland and went to Jefferson as her choice of schools to teach at. And I'm wondering if how the Portland School District deals with finding teachers who wish to go to a particular school teach. I mean, in your experience, are the teachers at Jefferson arbitrarily placed there? Do they choose to go there? Are they allowed to transfer out if they so wish?
Well, during the time that I did the study, Chair Cicero and Morissette, at the time I did the study, one of the administrators pointed out to me that many of the people there had been there a long time. And they also pointed out to me that there were problems. So I don't want to try to speak for the district with how they do something, but you need to ask the district on that point. But in terms of my report at the time, I think a number of those teachers have been there a long time. I wasn't talking about new teachers as much as I was talking about teachers that have been there for a long period of time who were not necessarily doing the job that was necessary, that was required. And I think in some instances, some people had tried to come there, and they were not allowed to come there. And there were some people that once they got there, if their first year, they went somewhere the second year.
Mm-hmm. Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is taking me back a long time in history. And you may not have asked that question of the district, because it takes me back to when we first started busing into the community. And at that time, I recall that the district was paying what we term combat pay. And do you know whether they still have that practice? What it really means is that they gave an incentive for white teachers to come in and teach within the community.
Yes, sir. I did run into that term, tied to teachers at in the Portland School District, and I know the city. I don't think that they're calling the comeback day today, but I don't think it's been offered today.
Because that also had an effect on the students, because the students also knew that that's what was taking place.
Dr. Henry, thank you very much.
Well, thank, Mr. Chair, thank you for inviting me to come and try to clarify and let you know that I stand by my report.
I appreciate it very much.
And I will be talking with the district next week about this, and hopefully we can clarify it. Again, I want to appreciate that, and I hope that whatever else that I can do to add to your discussion, I'll be available to do that.
I think if this committee chooses to establish the interim committee, then I'm sure that they'll want to call on you.
Appreciate it. Thanks a million.
Diane Cassidy and Caleb Burns.
Lanseri and members of the committee, my name is Diane Cassidy, and I live at 18280 Indian Creek Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon. And just to let you know, I am a former teacher. I taught for 10 years in the public school system in the Portland area. And I also substituted for a number of years after that. My principal interest here today is as a parent of a high school student who is, he is a 10th grader. And I have made myself very aware of and knowledgeable about the testing, Oregon statewide assessments, and their implication on education in Oregon. And I think that there is some real problems with our system that we need to be aware of. And that's what I'd like to talk to you about today. Pretty soon, probably at the end of the school year, parents are going to be seeing the results of the tests that students have been taking this last winter and spring. But what they need to know are the answers about the question about whether or not the tests are accurate and have meaningful results. In other words, did Oregon pass the test? Did the state create tests that truly measure individual student academic achievement? Are the tests fair, reliable, valid measures of a student's knowledge and skills in reading, writing, and math? What you have before you in this packet is a summary of some of the answers to the questions I have asked and the research that I have done in an attempt to resolve the serious reservations that I have about these tests. When I sat down to make a list of the problems, I found that the list grew too unwieldy to go over them all in detail at this hearing, although I have summarized them and will answer questions if you care to do that later. At this point, I would like to highlight a few of these problems for you, but I do hope that you will take time at some point to read the entire packet. I would like you to learn for yourself the truth behind the rhetoric that the tests are flawed. Our state law requires that the Department of Education shall implement statewide a valid and reliable assessment system for all students that meets technical adequacy standards. That's from ORS 329.485. I have to wonder exactly what checks and balances ensure that this mandate is being followed. My associate, Dr. Burns, can discuss more thoroughly why the tests do not comply with this law, while I would like to show you what happens when things go awry. If you will turn to, I think it's about the sixth page in this packet, you will see a page that I got off the internet website last night from the Oregon Department of Education assessment website, and it's a sample test in the grade 10 mathematics multiple choice test. I refer you to question 30 And this question has received some notoriety in the press, and I think in the last year, for having no correct answer among any of the multiple choice options. Since the actual tests that the kids are taking are secure documents, I cannot ascertain how many questions on those tests have this type of problem occurring, but this indicates inattention to detail and gross disregard for students who depend on the test creators to give them a fair chance to answer the test questions. I have to say that my son is very adept at finding these kinds of problems and brings them to my attention, so that whenever he does take a test, I find out that, yes, there are problems, and this is the type of problem that inflicts many.
Jenna Winters has a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question on testing, mm-hmm. because I had one of my constituents say to me that their son had taken the test and that it was greater that two of his answers were incorrect when, in fact, they were correct.
Was this on the multiple choice? Somehow I'm not surprised. I'm not sure how that happened, because in the multiple choice test, they should have it keyed and it should be done something by a computer. All I can say is that somebody wasn't paying attention. The example two, on the next page, this is a sample from the grade 10 mathematics multiple choice test. It was from a different set of form. This page here happened to come, these sample questions happened to come from my district, Lake Oswego School District, newspapers they sent out to parents last year. I refer you to question number one as a type of question that I believe is inappropriate for a math achievement test. In order to be a fair question, it would have to ask for knowledge or skills that can be taught. This particular problem demonstrates cognitive ability, and I believe that this is unfair because it does not test for knowledge that can be learned at school. On the next page, again, drawing from the website, assessment website. We're now on the grade 10 reading and literature sample test. The first page shows a chart of gold production in 1981 to 84 in various countries around the world. My only thoughts when I was reading this is that I guess that reading a chart is now what passes for reading skills in Oregon. Certainly, this is not what parents would expect to be on a reading and literature test. I have to wonder if this is what they're teaching in language arts classes these days. The next page, questions number 11 and 13 that refer to the chart, have little to do with reading and everything to do with math. You actually have to do computations or at least some type of estimation in order to determine the answer to these questions. I had to keep looking at the top of the page to be sure that I was still looking at a reading and literature test. On the next example, this one happens to be 7 pages long. I included the entire question and the responses. This, too, came from the Oregon Department of Ed website. Page one of the set shows a typical problem that 10th graders might choose to do on the problem-solving portion of the math exam. Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Close.
Could you just hold up the page you're on?
Thank you. It looks like a piece of graph paper.
Okay. Thank you.
This one shows the test. And this is what you see at the top is the scoring key that the different scores use. This is a performance assessment. And after the students answer the question, then they are sent off to various ESD sites for to be scored by two different scores. The next page, the next six pages come in sets of two. You will see first one response, which is the first one is a low scoring response, and the comments and the scores that were given to that response. The next one is supposed to be typical of a medium or mid-range scoring quality, I guess, scored test response. And the last one represents a high-scoring response, and again, with the corresponding notes from the scorer. I'd like to draw your attention to that very last high-scoring test and the comments made by the scorer. This is the one where everything is rated fives and sixes. If you look at the first two comments, you'll note that the scorer gave the student sixes because the student was able to connect his math solution to calculus. I doubt that there are more than a dozen students in the state who've had enough calculus by the 10th grade who could attempt such a feat. If this is what it takes to get a top score in Oregon, our kids are doomed. I'm speechless. I have no other comment about that. I'll move on. Following the math performance assessment, I do have some comments. I took the time to write to a math professor at Cal State University in Los Angeles, who's been heavily involved in the California math assessments and math standards, and his name is Dr. Wayne Bishop. And you can see for yourself some of the, just a couple of the questions that he answered for me. But in addition to his responses, I've done some further research, and I understand that performance assessments are problematic by their very nature and the difficulty of fairly teaching or assessing thinking skills presents a huge problem. I have listed a number of problems associated with this type of test. I'll run through them fairly quickly. It appears that it would be impossible to teach every problem-solving strategy necessary to answer the unique questions on the problem-solving math exam. Without instruction, the test becomes a test of cognitive ability, not academic achievement. Having to write a detailed solution to the problems makes this test a test of verbal and writing skills, not mathematical reasoning. Many gifted math students are not equally gifted in the verbal domain, and this would skew the results. After all, communication is 20% of the score on this test. Inter and intra-rater reliability is a problem on all performance assessments, making them the most subjective form of assessment of all. Questions exist as to the background and training of the math experts who do the scoring. There is no correlation to other standards of math achievement. Being a good math student will not guarantee a good result on performance assessments. A single performance task, such as we ask in Oregon, can only measure a limited portion of the domain. Multiple tasks are required to get a fair assessment of competency. Problem-solving skills cannot be tested with this format. And I refer you to Dr. Bishop for verification of that. The cost to administer performance assessments is astronomical compared to standard testing methods, and they have been estimated to be from 10 to 100 times that associated with traditional methods. According to Dr. Bishop, 10 good but much easier word problems covering the same material with multiple choice answers gives equivalent and very reliable information. They require no time nor money to score and analyze. It is the only way to go with broad screen, district, state, or national exams. There is no empirical data to support any claims of validity for problem-solving tests, and this is according to my district director of assessment. He said that the validity is all theoretical. There is no data. Exhibit 6, I believe, is a paper that I will leave for you to read, and I hope you do pay attention to it. It's called Standards-Based Education Reform, the Kentucky Experience. This will give an insight into another state's attempt at addressing educational reform using standards-based model. I hope you read it because it addresses some of the underlying assumptions that create a very flawed system. And I believe that's what we're dealing with here in Oregon. It does not take a rocket scientist to find the kinds of problems I have shown you here. This was easy, too easy. If these were the only problems we had to deal with, this test question or that test question, is it too easy, too hard, this has no correct answer, that sort of thing, maybe there would be some way to salvage the guts of the Oregon assessment program. But I'm afraid that these are the tip of the iceberg, and the underlying assumptions that drive the assessment program are flawed. Perhaps politics and education do not mix, and cutting-edge pedagogy ignores common sense. If I had hired a mechanic to fix my car, and his quality of service was as poor as our statewide assessment, I would have cut my losses and found another mechanic a long time ago. Of course, the best option would have been to do some research and find out which mechanic had the best track record before the money was spent. The loss of public funds is regrettable, but the loss of public trust is worse. There is an acronym in the educational field, WYTIWIG, and it stands for What You Test Is What You Get. No secret that testing drives the curriculum. And if the tests are suspect, what is happening to our curriculum? These issues are critical to the health of public education in Oregon. And I urge the House Education Committee to examine the assessment practices of the Oregon Department of Education and require fair and valid tests that meet technical adequacy standards. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. And I would be happy to answer questions.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I understood you correctly and the information that you provided with us, that I, of course, haven't had an opportunity to read thoroughly, but I have skimmed it, you really would like the assessment process repealed and not done.
You know, I am, and regardless of what you see here, there are some fine things that I see happening as a result of this assessment process. I have to say that because this is a very critical piece. I know that in my high school, the English teachers are very excited about the results that they get from the writing assessment. They feel that it's making them better teachers, able to point out some of the problems that in their own teaching, and helps them deal with individual students and the problems that an individual student has. However, none of them that I've talked to believe that it belongs as part of the high stakes assessment. So that there are some things that are happening within the school that I think are very positive. I also do like the fact that the assessment and the public nature of the result, that reporting of the results, has cast a spotlight on the effectiveness of our education, and it's forcing some schools to abandon some curriculums or methods that simply aren't working. And I am in favor of valid assessments. I think that all kids should be tested on an annual basis. And so I think parents need to know and want to know how their kids are doing. I think schools need to know how they're serving their clientele. I just believe that we need to have something that works better, that has that is data-driven, research-driven, and that has the proof to show its effectiveness before it's implemented with the kids.
On the English teachers, I noticed that one of the questions that you had was, or comments, that the English teachers at Lake Oswego High School had not taught English for 3 weeks. They had taught to the test for the assessment.
That's what one of the teachers told me, yeah.
What were they doing during that 3 weeks? If it
I wasn't in their classrooms, but I know that they were complaining that the test was taking up a great deal of time. I can't tell you exactly what they were doing.
They weren't doing English.
But it also includes part of their time was on the assessments themselves. The state writing assessment was done over a 3-day period, so that certain portions of each class day over 3 days was spent on just doing the writing assessment. Then the multiple choice test took up another period. And then other time, I would assume, would be for preparing kids to understand the format in case it is. That would be my assumption.
Representative Jensen.
You're talking about Lake Oswego High School or Lake Ridge?
The 3-week figure was a teacher at Lake Oswego High School, but I know that similar practices happen at Lake Ridge. My own student goes through Lake Ridge.
My granddaughter went to Lake Oswego, and that was my reason for inquiry there for some consistency. In looking at the, you know, some of the questions, if I could follow.
Sure.
The math test that you referred to, 96-63, quiz number, whatever sort of thing, is there something inherently wrong with a test that would measure whether or not a 10th grader could do that problem?
Are you talking about the problem-solving assessment?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
There is?
Yes. If you'll read some of the comments from Dr. Bishop, I'd rather quote him than take a wrong turn here and say something I regret. He has a very nice explanation for how do you actually assess, how can you assess problem-solving skills. It's not clear to me in this particular test that we have for our kids, are we testing their math ability or their problem-solving ability? If it's math ability, this really doesn't do the job, as I've explained. It only measures a very, very, very minor or very slender domain. You're only asking about one set of a very narrow set of computational skills that need to be applied when you just ask one question. Even complex questions don't really get at a full breadth of knowledge. If you're asking whether or not, since it's called a problem-solving test, then you have to ask the question, does it actually measure problem-solving ability? And that's where Dr. Bishop answers, and I have read this elsewhere also, but I like his wording. It's simple and very quick. An individual, honest, and knowledgeable teacher can tell a whole lot on just one item such as these. You keep asking leading questions until they see what's going on. If a couple of cues are enough and the student has never seen the problem before, you can be pretty certain that you have a good problem solver. Without a knowledgeable leader being able to offer cues, even a good students can score zero level. Obviously, this is quite subjective, so cannot be trusted as a broad screen evaluation. When I posed the question, I wanted to ask somebody who I knew was very familiar with the Oregon assessment and had been involved in, I'm not sure about this one in particular, but with different aspects of the math assessment creation. I talked to Ron Smith, our Director of Assessment in Lake Oswego School District, and I talked to him just a couple of days ago in preparation for exactly this kind of question, and I asked him, is there any valid data that shows, or excuse me, is there any data that shows this is a valid way of measuring problem-solving skills? If that's what the test is supposed to measure, does it measure problem-solving? And he explained to me that there is no data, that all of the concepts behind this type of a test are theoretical in nature and cannot and do not have data to back them up. What we're doing here is taking something that, with this test, is taking something that sounds good, looks good, seems like it ought to work, but we have no idea. This is testing problem-solving skills. There is no data to prove it. Can it be done? Well, according to Dr. Bishop, it can be done with a good teacher sitting down and talking to a student. Again, performance assessments have been traditionally used by teachers in a classroom to test whether or not the kids are getting it. You know, do they have a complete understanding? As a teacher, I know this. That's their best and highest use, is as a tool for the classroom teacher to assess if the kid is understanding the curriculum. As a broad an assessment for thousands of kids or even hundreds of kids, it's difficult, if not impossible, to standardize and validate.
Representative Beck.
I've got a couple of questions. On your page 4 of your testimony, you say some things I want to clarify. This is where you have some problems with Oregon statewide assessment program. Lake Oswego, like many districts in the state, is changing its curriculum to fit requirements of the CIM. Traditional survey of history courses are being abandoned in favor of a thematic approach to necessary topics. Can you explain to me why that's necessarily a bad idea, and or what other changes in the curriculum are occurring that you're aware of?
I'll talk about Lake Oswego in a minute. First of all, I haven't seen their entire program. They have been spending the last year doing a complete curriculum revision. The final revision is not available yet. It's probably going to be presented to the school board next month. I can't talk specifically about Lake Oswego and my take on the final product.
If I can interrupt.
Sure.
So as far as you know, their curriculum changes may be suitable to a modern world. They're changing their curriculum for variety of reasons.
Let me back up and explain it in one other way. My husband plays on the baseball team of guys over 50, and I have to say that because one of the guys on his baseball team just retired last year from the Portland School District, where he taught at Langdon High School in social studies, and he was the international baccalaureate teacher, and he taught history. So he did teach survey of history. And when I say a survey of history, that's a chronological look at a period of time. And if we're talking about American history, it usually starts with exploration and then moves quite into colonization up through, you know, present day. That's the normal survey sequence that you would get for U.S. history. He was so disturbed by the changes that his school was making in the curriculum to suit the requirements of the Certificate of Initial Mastery test. Social studies testing. He felt that the curriculum was being test-driven and that he was abandoning what he knew to be a fine, high-quality program in favor of something that he felt was going to be less quality, and he frankly didn't want to be a part of it. I hate putting words into somebody else's mouth, and so perhaps if he came here today, he might say things a little differently, but this is what I understood. And there are many people out there who feel that this is, in this particular instance, or I think in any instance, this test should be a reflection of a good curriculum, not the, they should not be driving curriculum. Tests should be a way to measure the curriculum that you have established that you feel has quality integrity should not be what drives the creation of the curriculum. And that's what's happening here. You're putting that fixed part of the cart before the horse.
Follow up, if you want, Chair. Another down the row, students without SIMS may be ineligible for admission to state colleges, scholarships, and other opportunities.
Well, some of those things have been changing. I have been doing some looking into what's being required. For many years, we've been told that part of the Oregon Education Act of the 21st century is that it would be a seamless system, that we would have kids starting in, you know, kindergarten or pre-kindergarten going all the way through college, and that the skills learned in one area would then be used as a basis to move you through the system. And for quite some time, parents have been told, and it's actually been on part of the documents for the Oregon State System of Higher Education, now called the Oregon University System, that the SIMS would be a requirement for admissions at some point in the future. And the year 2000, fall of 2001, was that would begin with the current 10th graders. In February, that did change, and the Oregon, the State Board of Higher Education came up with a new policy that now makes the SIM an option only, at least until the year 2004. So it's, those sort of things are still being held out there as a possibility or as a likelihood that they will happen. So some of the time frames have changed, but it seems to me that the intent is remaining the same, that the SIM is being used as sort of a ticket for admissions to colleges, as well as perhaps scholarships. I know it's been mentioned by the governor, and it's been a bill that's even been, I think, seen this committee. Have looked at types of legislation that would reward and give incentives for people having SIMS.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I can just comment, just there's so much here, and
it is.
And
it's huge.
And this is a huge undertaking. We are trying this whole Education Act and this SIM. We've really just got started. I mean, I hope you appreciate that. This is just the beginning. We've put it off by half a dozen years or so because we haven't funded it. We've been fighting the school funding battle for this whole decade instead of funding the schools and giving the teachers the training. So it's kind of, you know, the teachers, I haven't met a teacher who's happy with this testing, but a lot of them don't want to give it up either. And I think a lot of them acknowledge we want to give it a shot. And a lot of, I think we're all wrestling with it, but I think it's premature to be foretelling the certain failure of this type of system and assessment. We really haven't had a chance to give it a shot. We do know our schools need some changes, and we know that this public school system has failed a lot of kids in this country, and we've addressed that by trying to do some things differently. And I guess I get concerned when we start, you know, announcing that this just hasn't worked, it's failed. I think we still have a lot. This is still, we're just getting started. And I'd encourage you and teachers and us, too. I mean, I wrestle with this, too. I mean, what sort of changes do we need to make? But, you know, I'm not ready to yet to say that curriculums have transformed in a way that is necessarily harmful. Some people say the tests are too hard. Some people say they're not hard enough. You say that here, too, essentially.
Okay.
It's all over the map. I guess the other thing that I'm concluding as I've thought this through the last few months is everybody needs to lighten up about this thing. These tests, they're just tests. They're ways of assessing kids. Colleges, if you're a kid that maybe doesn't do so well in the SIM but gets a 1,200 or 1,300 on the SAT and is in the drama and speaks three foreign languages and writes good essays, they're still going to get into Harvard, probably.
No.
Well, I don't know. I don't think that colleges are that unsophisticated about this. And I just think, to some extent, we all need to step back and go, you know, it will take some time to work itself out. Yes, it's a lot of pressure on teachers and kids and parents right now, but in time, teachers will be more integrated, have this kind of teaching more integrated into their normal way of being. Hopefully, we'll have a longer school year, which I think will help, too, restructured school year as well. There are all kinds of things we still need to do that will, I think, make this not quite so threatening to people. Change is hard, no doubt about it. But I think I would encourage people to help figure out how to make it work rather than to just shelving it. And I'm not sure you're suggesting shelving it. I can't tell. But anyway, that's just some comments.
We need to move on a little bit. The Representative Hobson, question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine is a question, but also I'm afraid an editorial comment. I was wondering I was wondering if you were aware that one of the largest or biggest criticisms that K-12 receives from higher ed is that the students we send to them are not prepared, and that one of the purposes, and I know you've done a lot of research and probably are aware that higher ed has been intimately involved in order to try and bridge that gap.
I've talked to many people.
In fact, I think it's about 11 to 18% rate where students that are coming to higher ed
can't read.
Remediate.
Yeah, and I think with your last Dr. Johnson, you know, it's a complex problem, and there are many reasons why that's occurring.
Mr. Burns.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Mr. Chairman Sunseri and other members of the House Education Committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today, and I'm really in favor of House Bill 2549. But a lot of people may be speaking, so I'll keep my remarks brief. My name is Caleb Burns. I'm a licensed psychologist practicing in the Portland area. I live in Lake Grove, Lake Oswego, Oregon. And I think the major question regarding the SIM test can be seen as this, and this is: if you're going to offer your child a medication that was powerful, as the SIM tests are in deciding who will go into college, what superintendents will be paid at the highest rate, what teachers will prosper, who will go to summer schools, if you offer your children a powerful medication with absolutely no proof of safety and effectiveness, would you force such a medication on your child, other youngsters in Oregon? Obviously, the answer is not. And that's exactly what the SIM tests are now. They're unproven as to safety and effectiveness. I've been trying to get validity data from Tanya Gross, spokesperson for the ODE, for well over 2 months. In her last letter to me, this dated April 13, 1999, she claimed that she had sent me all the validity data that the ODE has in the SIM test, but there was nothing about the validity of the SIM test. That is, we do not know how the scores on the SIM test will comport to scores in any other tests. We do not know if high scores on the SIM test will actually mean lower scores on the SATs. We know nothing about what a score on a SIM test means, other than that it's changing the face of education in Oregon. It's eroding the self-confidence of many students, and it's forcing teachers to teach through the test. Dr. Steve Slater of ODE's Office of Assessment and Evaluation was quoted in Wednesday's Oregonian newspaper in Portland as saying the ODE is, quote, trying to use as much science as possible, close quotes. You may have seen the article, and this is the withdrawal of the math test that was at least renorming, right, for 80,000 kids. At any rate, he said, we're trying to be as scientific as possible. And he said this as he explained the need to renorm the math sim that was distributed to 80,000 youngsters in Oregon. But he knows that the OD has not followed basic test construction guidelines in creating the sim test. For example, the ODE promised to follow the 1985 test construction guidelines, and the first guideline in this book, and I made copies of it in there for you, at least some of the relevant pages. First standard says evidence of validity should be presented for the major types of inferences for which the use of a test is recommended. But this has not occurred. There is no such evidence of any validity. The second of the 1985 guidelines says if validity for some common interpretation has not been investigated, that fact should be made clear and potential users should be cautioned against or about making such interpretations. But nowhere has the ODE says we have no validity. Treat this stuff with caution. It's full speed ahead. And Among the other necessary steps outlined in the 1985 guidelines, in which the OED is not followed, is this. Test users should not imply that empirical evidence exists for a relationship among particular test results, prescribed educational plans, and a desired student outcomes unless such evidence is available. And what is a certificate of mastery test but a claim to bring about initial mastery, whatever that means? What validity refers to is whether or not the test measures what it says it measures. And there are three general areas of validity. People draw these lines differently, but the first area is content validity. And that is, how do we know that the items in a test are a good sample of the universe of items measuring the things we want to measure? The ODE claims it has content validity because a group of unnamed experts, parents, teachers, and so on, has suggested or specified or indicated or done whatever in some areas, and some questions appear to reflect some of these areas. And I'd be happy to talk about a conversation I had with Metrotech, Inc. out of Champaign, Illinois. At any rate, the 1985 guidelines for test construction are far more demanding than sort of getting a group of experts together. And the 85 guidelines requires, among other things, that the expertise of the test constructors be given along with the decision tree as to how they reach agreement among test items that are in dispute and so on. The guidelines require that the criteria for test for item inclusion be made clear. Simply to say that one has a group of experts and therefore this test has content validity is idiotic. For unless there is other proof of validity, opinions of so-called experts are simply opinions. Remember new math, whole language. Remember the flat earth theory. And unless there are clear and widely agreed upon criteria for content, there can be great variation in item coverage, fads can be forced on students, and so on. In psychology, and I do testing all the time, I know there are tons of fads forced on kids and people and so on. The second area of validity that I want to refer to is criterion reference validity, and this refers to how SIM scores relate to other outcome measures, including possibly other test scores. That is, the SIM test should be compared to scores in other tests, including the ACT, the SATs, whatever is available. Of course, the scores should be compared to, of course, they could be compared to performance, job performance, rankings by teachers, and so on. But no criterion reference validity has been gathered on the SIM test. And without such validity, we don't know what the tests are measuring or how the scores may be affecting performance on the SAT tests or other tests. And one of my handouts here shows some of the information I'm interested in gathering, and that's this test. These are called validity coefficients, and these show the relationship between scores on among various tests and how well they correlate with each other. There is nothing like this that ODE has. They haven't done the basic statistical analysis of these things. Let me go on. The third general area of validity is called construct validity, and this refers to whether the tests do indeed measure the particular skills one is interested in measuring. Let me point out that one of the problems with poor construct validity, and the SIM test may well be more of a measure of an ability to memorize trivia, and Mrs. Cassidy talked about that, than a measure of achievement. Therefore, it may be that the youngsters who do well on the SIM test just have better memories than youngsters who do not do well on the SIM test. But that is not the same as measuring school achievement. However, with the current very, very primitive state of the test construction of the SIM test, we don't know what the SIM tests are measuring or whether indeed the SIM tests are actually harmful to our kids. For example, it may turn out that the SIM itself may erode a youngster's chance of doing well on the SATs and another widely accepted nationally normed test. That is, curricula are being changed, course schedules are being changed, et cetera, to comport with the SIM requirements. And there is only so much time in an academic day. Who knows what impact this will have on the ability of youngsters to do well on college entrance tests? And if the ODE won't show us the numbers, we will never know for sure. Again, it is like forcing our children to swallow powerful medication that has not been proved to be safe and effective. And one excellent solution to this expensive debacle, I think, is to throw away the SIM test entirely, at least until they've been validated with a pilot group of youngsters and not applied to all the youngsters in Oregon, and to turn instead to well-proven, widely accepted, nationally normed tests, such as the California Achievement Test, the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, the CTBS, and so on. It's important to recognize that we should not restrict our children's educational horizons or ambitions to Oregon. So why not use achievement tests that have proven validity and which are acclaimed by other school systems and which other universities, colleges, high schools, et cetera, accept? How many millions of dollars, and in Kentucky with billions, would it be, how many millions of dollars have been wasted thus far by the OED in trying to force the SIM and other fads in the schools of Oregon, and how many more millions are likely to be squandered by this foolish approach, at least continuing it without close analysis? Why not save this money and throw out the SIM test and also the unproved benchmarks and turn to proven assessment frameworks? Clearly, our children are worth it. So And we come back to the basic question. Why would we begin to force on our children, grandchildren, the students of Oregon, unproved, untested assessment measures created by people who are not following the basic test construction guidelines and want to hide their lack of information from you? I applaud the sense of Steve Slater's Wednesday statement that the OED is trying to use as much science as possible. This is not only ethical and appropriate, it is also legal, for the state assessments were designed to meet with the legislation, which calls for a, quote, valid and reliable assessment for all students that meets technical adequacy standards, close quotes. Thus far, the OED has failed miserably, miserably in this area. So I urge the committee to continue to demand statistical data proving the value of the SIM test and of the benchmarks and so on. Don't be conned by mere opinions. And don't let the OED operate without close observation. Science works best in the light with peer review, with verifiable data. And until they can prove validity data to this education committee, which shows that their tests are safe and effective, ODE staff should be told to stop abusing Oregon's children by forcing them to take these high-stakes, very expensive, unproved tests. Again, I thank you for your time, and please feel free to ask me questions or contact me if I could be of help.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would ask the same question. Is it accurate to interpret your statements? You really want it thrown out.
One thrown out, ma'am.
The assessment and the SIM and all of the associated parts to it.
I think that some of the assessment portions are very good. I think that the focus on evaluation and holding kids to a high standard is very good indeed, and I'm glad that we're doing that. My problem is that these standards, as they have been forced on the schools, are unproven standards. They are not demonstrated to be safe and effective, as I say. There are a variety of other tests, I think, that are excellent tests. The benchmarks themselves, when I called up the state, there was no validity information that the state told me for the benchmarks. I am a real believer in high standards and testing to those standards. All I do all day long is test kids and adults and so on, and I believe in test standards. I'm interested in changing these things dramatically, and if there is no good validity information, then finding tests and approaches which have such data. But until there are such approaches to it, we better think a lot, long and hard, before we, you know, use these expensive tests to assess our kids.
Perhaps I can follow up. It may have been the way I worded it wasn't clear, because if I understood your testimony correctly, you feel that the Iowa, the CTBS, and the rest of those are exactly what should be used.
I think the rest of those other tests are excellent tests in evaluating the competence of students in a variety of areas. It doesn't mean that I would use those tests to determine how youngsters should be taught, the in-classroom behaviors and so on, but if we want kids to reach a high standard, we can't throw away the measures, the nationally normed, widely accepted measures of these tests, and invent a series of assessments that's for Oregon kids only.
Are you aware that these new ways of assessment are being used in the other states, including Kentucky?
Mr. Chair, California is getting rid of the new math. It's trying its best to do so. If I in psychology were faced with a test that was unproven, it would not make any difference to me if people were using it or not. If the data did not support it, I think that I would be acting unethically to do something without support. A bandwagon effect is not a good thing. There are a variety of logical fallacies. One is the fallacy of the false alternative. Either it's going to be this or this. Either we adopt a SIM or we're going to go down a road for ignorance and so on. Another one is a bandwagon effect, too, I think, where we say, because other people are doing it, we will necessarily do it. Anyway, that's a logical fact. There's also something called consensual drift, and I think that's probably operating in some of the ODE thinking, too. Consensual drift is when you have people that agree among themselves about a particular issue, but they drift further and further out from the main field. And I think that without data to tie us closely into the field, we're going to be in a world of hurt. The diabetic who's got to take insulin or monitor his or her sugar levels and so on is not interested in opinion. They want to look at the numbers, they want to look at the safety, and it's on those things that science depends, the numbers.
That's there wasn't.
I just want to say I enjoy your testimony, and I believe it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Can I make one
Absolutely.
Final comment? Representative Beck, when you had commented that you thought that perhaps people ought to give the SIM test and the test news program a shot to see if it would work, my comment to you is that if it doesn't work, if we're going to wait an X period of time and we find that at the end of the time it wasn't working as well as we wanted or it hasn't worked at all, what will have happened during that time is you will have lost the trust and the faith of the people of Oregon and the parents, and you will have destroyed the public school system, because once the trust in that system is lost, it would be difficult or impossible to regain. Kids, people are abandoning the public school whenever and wherever they can, if they've got the money to do so or if they have a viable alternative. When they see that things, when they have, their gut tells them this isn't going to work for my kid. And if we have a program that was dependent upon unproven tests, and where the tests are actually driving the program, driving the curriculum, I don't think we can afford to wait and see if it works. This is where it's extremely important, and it is the state's responsibility to make sure that the testing comes first and the proof comes before the change, not asking us to simply live with whatever happens.
Thank you.
Sir, may I make one quick comment right along? Really quick, sir.
Okay.
And that is, you know, when people say trust us, when OD says trust us, and the check's in the mail, the check probably is in the mail, and you probably shouldn't trust them, especially if our children's lives are on the line. We need the data. And using science means you don't have to take risks. First you try it in pilot studies. First you test it out. You know it works, and then you put it in. You don't, Steve Slater was quoted as saying something. Anyway. This is only the third year we have done math problem solving, so we are still learning how to do things better each year. Why didn't he know how to do it before he implemented it? And then we wouldn't have to waste time, energy, and children's lives in this thing. Science means we don't have to guess.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to recess from 2549, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2471. And I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2471, and I'm going to open public hearing on House Bill 3475 and close public hearing on House Bill 3475. The Chair's going to appoint a work group on the homeschool bill.
Excuse me a second. You're going to have to slow down just a sliver for this person.
Okay, the very last page.
Just
tapping these in so that we can hear them.
Oh, I got the last page. I just got this, so I didn't know they were there.
Okay. Chair's going to appoint a work group on the homeschool bill, and Representative Starr will lead that. Get some amendments to bring that back, and you can invite people that were testifying on that bill if you like to participate in that group. And if there's any member of the committee who would like to participate in that group, you're welcome to join them. I want to go to a... work session on House Bill 2252, and if the committee administrator just give us a kind of a summary on that, we'll see if there's a will to move that from the committee.
Okay, House Bill 2252 establishes a community service voucher fund that would be separate from the general fund to receive monies for redemption of the vouchers authorized by the community service voucher program. The fund and its interest are appropriated to the State Scholarship Commission to finance the program that is authorized in statute.
The committee have any questions? If two gentlemen that were testifying earlier have remained for this, if there's any questions left on this bill. Okay, we're in work session. I'm open for a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I move House Bill 2252 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Starr moves House Bill 2252 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Senator Post?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Wilson?
Aye.
Votes aye. Motion is passed. Representative Starr will carry that bill?
Sure.
Okay, Representative Starr will carry that bill. Okay. Is there anyone here that wants to testify on House Bill 2549 that has not yet? We had some teachers that were going to be here at 4:15, so we'll just recess until 4:20.